everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, an in-depth special on climate change, the two-degree limit, and the politicization of global warming limits. My first panelist today is Professor Christopher Shaw from Sussex, United Kingdom. He is an associate at the Tyndale Center for Climate Change Research and a visiting fellow at the Sussex Energy Group. For the past decade, he has researched climate change policies and climate communications and has conducted research for the Environmental Change Institute, the University of Nottingham, Sussex University, and the Institute for Development Studies. Chris received his doctorate in global climate policy from the University of Sussex School of Law, Politics, and Sociology. He is the author of several books, the most recent being The 2-Degree Dangerous Limit for Climate Change, which was published last October. His website is dangerouslimits.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for giving me the chance to share with you my thoughts.
I've seen different numbers noted for how much of the Earth's temperature has increased during the past 100 years or so, and including the pre-industrial period. To date, it seems to be almost 1 degree Celsius, around 0.85 degrees above pre-industrial levels. The climate science community says repeatedly that a 2 degree Celsius or 3.6 degree Fahrenheit increase is a dangerous limit. I personally feel it's very realistic to predict that we will pass this threshold in, let's say, 20 years or less, if there is no dramatic and revolutionary change in fossil fuel consumption. However, for the average person, a 1 or 2 degree increase seems to be a pittance and nothing to worry about. However, we are not speaking about simple atmospheric warming as an average, but rather the planet's average surface area itself. So please begin by clearing up this confusion so people can fully understand what a 2 degree Celsius global warming limit means. And then, in your estimation, after reviewing the science and the concerns of other climate scientists, when might we reach that threshold? I realize it's speculation, but please give us your best guesstimate. And then, what might be the more devastating consequences and threats to Western civilization, or the worst-case scenarios when we reach the 2 degrees threshold? What will the future and beyond look like? The forum is yours.
Thanks very much, Gary. As you highlight, this 2 degrees figure seems very low. So why would we be worrying about it? The fact is that, because it is an average, it means that we have to take into account the oceans. So we're always talking about the oceans and the atmosphere. They're almost like two fluids that are rubbing up against each other. And so we have to take account the fact that a lot of that heat will go into the oceans. And the other important issue when we consider about this 2 degrees average is that this means, for example, at the poles of the Earth, the North and South Pole, the warming will be much more rapid. So a global average warming of 2 degrees indicates or could result in around 5 degrees centigrade of warming at the poles, which could then trigger, and is indeed already triggering, rapid loss of ice. And people talk about future sea level rises, which are very long term, and I think are very difficult for people to understand and get worried about if it's 1,000 years from now. But what we are seeing already is, as a result of those changes at the poles, are shifts in global weather patterns, weakening of the jet stream. And as a result, we start to see more extreme weather patterns already appearing and then actually holding, so they don't move through as rapidly. Here in the UK, we're repeatedly facing floods, storms. And what's happening is that those weather systems come and then they stay, and that rain remains and falls ever more intensely. Also, the capacity of the earth to, or the atmosphere to, hold moisture increases as the air warms, so that the rainfall, the amount of rainfall that falls over a particular period, increases all the time. And again, I know in the US you've had some very warm temperatures over the winter and then some very severe snowstorms. And here in the UK, we have had record-breaking daily amounts of rainfall and extensive flooding. So that's happening at 1 degree of warming. And that's because actually the changes, this idea of an average hides, masks so many variations, so many different changes across the globe, that it becomes almost a rather useless metric for understanding how we might cope in a world that's 2 degrees warmer. How those changes will be expressed is very difficult to make sense of through this rather vague average, which also doesn't speak to so many of the other impacts that emerge. Some of these are indeed about physical dangers, but they're also very cultural. For example, Inuit people in Greenland, they're saying their culture, because they can't get onto the ice and hunt because the ice is too thin. So their culture is rapidly disappearing, their way of life, and that has profound psychological as well as economical and physical impacts. So the problem is that this 2 degree idea has emerged from Western institutions, from laboratories, from universities, from very privileged elite backgrounds, from people whose lifestyles, whose comfort is not perhaps immediately threatened in the way that other people's are. So those, I think, are some of the problems. And then, of course, the warming of the oceans. Again, you know, it's very popular to talk about sea level rise, and that will, of course, have massive impacts. But it's very difficult, as I've said before. I do a lot of work, not so much on the science, but how will the public understand the science, what the communication of the science means to the public. And these long-term problems don't really engage people. They don't mean much to people when global warming and climate change is talked about in terms of a global problem, in terms of a long-term problem, in terms of abstract numbers. People, we navigate the world through values, through stories, through our immediate lived experience. And so, of course, what we can see happening, and the science is there, it's not just about sea level rise, but as the oceans absorb this warming, so the acidity increases. That has impacts on life forms such as plankton, etc., and the ability of marine creatures to form the calcium shells. You get coral bleaching. And indeed, many of the projections of what will happen at 2 degrees indicate that coral reefs will be potentially extinct at 2 degrees of warming. Now, 20% of the ocean's biomass life is found in coral reefs. It's very difficult to imagine if you take out 20% of the ecosystem of the oceans, quite how the remaining 80% continues to function, and what that means for human existence. So underneath this very benign, small number of 2 degrees sits a profound and perhaps unknowable range of impacts. And what we lose by this aggregation of all these differences, all these variations, all these nuances into this simple number is really where those risks are. And I think, and this is, there's been a number of publications, well, I think it was two in the series, Late Lessons from Early Warnings, very interestingly looked at how we have failed time and time again to really take account of the risks that industrial activity is generating, always looking on the, you know, bright side and being very optimistic. This is what the 2 degrees thing is doing. But I think this would be a harder lesson to learn from. Very few opportunities we get this wrong to understand, respond, and fix the damage done. Now, the question you asked, or one of the questions you asked then, okay, so when do we expect the 2 degree limit to be reached? I think that, there again, and I think these estimations suffer from the same weaknesses as the aggregation of all these impacts into one number suffer from. It's a very crude figure. Generally, it's been assumed that in the year 2100 is when the 2 degree warming will be reached. Now, there's a couple of things to consider when we look at this idea. A, it assumes a very straight line increase in the temperature of the Earth. So it just goes up by the same amount year on year in a nice steady line, and that allows us to plan what's going to happen, know what's going to happen, respond to what's going to happen. If you were to look at the graphs of how that warming has expressed itself over the last 100 years, it's a very jagged line with peaks and troughs, which are very difficult to predict. One of the reasons why 2 degrees is said to be a dangerous limit is that it may be a point at which actually climate change accelerates. It's what's called the term that scientists use is a feedback mechanism. What they mean is, for example, if it got so warm that the ice was melting, then and areas in such areas as Alaska, then other gases would be released from the rotting vegetation, and they would feed into this process, making it faster, which would accelerate in turn again the melting of the ice, the rotting of the vegetation, even more gases coming back into it. So you get this accelerating process. And the concern is that, at 2 degrees, this process starts to begin. But of course, there's so many uncertainties. It could happen before we reach 2 degrees. This all leads me to say that we don't really know. The planning that is used to develop ideas about what we should do about climate change assume that 2 degrees won't be reached until the year 2100. But the other important relevant issue, I think, that may be of interest to listeners is that, but that doesn't actually, we have to stop introducing greenhouse gases at least 50 years in advance of that date. So in order to prevent in the year 2100 the planet warming by 2 degrees, it is assumed that the carbon massive reductions in the amount of greenhouse gases that we emit have to be achieved by the year 2050. So it's not that we've got till 2100 to sort things out. Even if we took and assumed and accepted that it was climate change would be dangerous to 2 degrees, actually, the gases remain in the system for a long time and do the damage for a long time. So if we accepted that it wouldn't warm until the year 2100, then we would actually have to make sure that we were no longer emitting greenhouse gases by the year 2050. So I think those are the important issues to bear in mind. And Gary, the other point you mentioned was, well, what's going to happen at 2 degrees centigrade? And I've already sort of talked about what's happening already at 1 degree centigrade with the oceans acidifying, with weather systems changing. And I would suggest that, today, after 2015 was the warmest year on record globally, and not just by a little bit, it was a massively warmer than the year 2014. And 2014 was itself a record-breaking year. So I don't think really anymore, when I look, I don't think I see many voices now. It may be different in America, but in Europe, there's not many voices now who could, who were skeptic, who were saying there's no such thing as climate change. They're pretty silent now. It's pretty hard to say the climate isn't changing. You may get a few people saying, well, it's not caused by us. But I don't think anyone anymore can deny that the climate is changing. So at 1 degree, the effects are already very profound. In the UK, again, to come back to my example, December 2014, warmest December, sorry, December 2015, warmest December on record, the wettest December on record. So our lives are already changing at 1 degree of warming. Okay, so there's still food on the shelves. There's still petrol available for cars. The roads are still functioning. Airports are still functioning. The system is still functioning. However, I would like, again, this idea of, well, you know, so it's just going to be a little bit different next year and we can plan for that. That's not really how it seems to be working out. I would like to cast my mind back to in Europe in 2003, we had a heat wave in Europe, which was the scientists said actually the greatest natural disaster to hit Europe. It killed 30,000 people, and that was at 0.75 degrees of warming. In that heat wave, what was happening was in France, which is very dependent on nuclear power, they were having to shut down their nuclear power plants because the river water they used to cool the nuclear power was too hot to do the job. There were droughts, there was massive impacts on food production, massive impacts on the water systems. And so you just don't know when these peaks within this ongoing trend, peaks of flooding, peaks of warming, peaks of drought, peaks of extreme cold weather, they're becoming ever more intense, ever more frequent. And it's just a question of really how much can the system function? I've come back to this 2003. Some people say that when the planet warms by 2 degrees centigrade, every summer in Europe will be like 2003. And if you look at the damage that was being done, it becomes very difficult to accept that Europe could function, that sort of civilization could function, if every summer was like that, given the impacts that happened then. So those, I think, are indications that I think we've got much to worry about between now and 2 degrees. And I think it's very difficult to just extrapolate in a very sort of simple manner from what's happening now to what will happen at 2 degrees. It's uncharted territory for humanity.
I appreciate your insights. I would like to bring together several disparate points and see the common connection. For example, last year there were more than 12,000 unique weather events in the United States, over 125,000 worldwide. By unique weather events, I mean we had the hottest day up to that point in recorded history of our country. We had the longest amount of rain. We had the largest tornado in Oklahoma. We had more earthquakes in Oklahoma than at any time in Oklahoma's history. In fact, Oklahoma had more earthquakes than the rest of the United States combined because of gas hydrofracking. We also saw sandstorms. Now, we are familiar in the 1930s with the Great Dust Bowl and dust storms. But a sandstorm is something that you would expect in the Arab countries, in Saudi Arabia, in the deserts, in the Sahara Desert. No, this was not in the Sahara Desert. This was in Phoenix, Arizona, and that was only one of many. With winds of 50 miles an hour plus, the sand was exfoliating car, paint, windows, whatever it hit, and these were huge, as the people who lived there said they'd never seen this before. We also last year found that there's an area in the Pacific Ocean that is warmer than the rest of the Pacific Ocean by several degrees. 4 degrees approximately. But what's of interest is how many dead fish and mammals in that area. And then we started seeing massive die-offs we've never seen in American history, going from California clear up to Alaska. Hundreds of thousands of mammals dying, sea lions and walruses and whales. We hadn't seen that before, and yet they had no specific cause. Was it from Fukushima? Was it from a lack of their plankton or the krill or whatever they were eating? They didn't come up with an answer. But we know that the die-off occurred. Then in over 100 rivers of the world, they had the highest kill-off of fish. And again, they did not know why. They only had speculative questions. We also saw some other phenomena, more dead zones in the oceans and larger than before. And the coral reefs began to bleach out. The acidification, as you mentioned, the ocean intensified. And yet, depending upon where you're living, you would not have noticed this. Now, here's the point that I'm making. until Hurricane Sandy, which was only a Category 1, just a 1, it caused over 2 million people living in the New York area to be affected, killed thousands of people, but also caused almost $100 billion in damages. No one was prepared for it. Now we realize that can happen. I used to have an apartment in South Beach. For 12 years, South Beach is only is a part of Miami Beach, and it's the part that actually faces the Atlantic Ocean. It's very narrow. It's only about 10 blocks wide. It's widest. And it's not that long. And you get to it by a bridge that goes over the bay. Well, you saw something unusual. Suddenly, at nighttime, when I was running on the beach, I would see the tides coming in. But when I'd run in the morning at 5 o'clock, I would see the seaweed real, real high, up on sometimes on the outside of the bottom of hotel swimming pools, because the pool was the structure closest to the water. I'd never seen that in 15 years running on the beach. And also, there's a road called Alton Road, and it's the road that is the other side of South Beach, and it's the road that's most heavily trafficked, and people go up to it to go on up to North Miami. It was flooded virtually every night, not because there were storms, but because of the tides coming in at higher levels. When Sandy hit, the entire downtown of Manhattan, below 21st Street or lower, was blacked out because all of the computer systems, a lot of the electrical systems, the subway systems were in lower Manhattan, which is still 5 or 6 feet above sea level, but they were all flooded because of the surge. And so people began to realize, gee whiz, this is unusual. And I kept saying, this is the new norm. And now we're seeing rain in certain parts of Texas where there's droughts and others. There's so much drought that 6 million people living in the state of Texas in 1,200 communities do not have adequate water and their aquifers are empty. But in other areas of Texas, the Northeast, we had over 67 days of straight rain, a record. And I mean, at times there were massive amounts of rain, like 8 to 10 inches in one day, completely flooding anything that was at a ground level and causing massive problems. So when you look at the amount of natural disasters in the last 2 to 3 years, and the average person says, but it wasn't that hot, or it wasn't that cold, or the storm wasn't that bad, and it depends upon if you were in that storm or if you're in northern England where you were referring to having all that rain and villages that had never been flooded as they were recently. Now they have massive amounts of mold. Their foundations have been disjointed because of the water being so high for so long. And it's going to cost them sometimes tens of thousands of pounds for those people to clean up and make environmentally safe getting back into their homes. And then they have to question, will this happen again next year? So for hundreds of years, people lived a rather consistent lifestyle in your country, in the northern areas, and in Wales. They can no longer guarantee that that's the case. And yet we're still not at that 2 degrees. So my question then is, when you look at all the different unique weather anomalies around the world, at the extremes that we're seeing, and people adapting to them as if, well, I'm lucky I don't live at that location, I live in a different location, and our government's doing nothing as a mandatory requirement to reduce our consumption of that which causes global warming, like eating animals or some of the other things that we could do and choose not to, then how do you see the likelihood that there's going to be any mandate for change when we're simply maladapting to nature as if somehow it won't be as bad the next time, and we're just at 1 degree on our way to 2 degrees, but these are things happening in our lifetime, not our future generations' lifetimes. Your thoughts, please.
Thanks, Gary. Yes, and that is going to be a very difficult question to answer. I work for an organization called Climate Outreach, and we're trying to close that gap, trying to understand how to build that engagement, the understanding amongst the public, that it's an extent that would lead to changes in behavior. Though the change, you know, in terms of, as you talked about, you know, not doing the things that create the part, you know, these emissions that are driving these changes. Now, the but when you look at the research, a lot, you know, people say, look, if you ask me to change a light bulb, you know, I know, on one hand, you tell me huge risks, huge problem. How is changing a light bulb or recycling a can going to do anything? We want there to be change. We want renewable energy systems. I can't go and build a wind farm. I need the government to act on my behalf. Now, this comes through time and time again in the research. People are worried. And I'm just about to do some research now with people in Scotland who are suffering badly. And I'm going up there to ask them, you know, what do they think of the issues that Scotland faces? Is climate change one of them? What would you like to see done? It's going to be very interesting to see, given the extreme weather that's been happening in Scotland, what they say. And is climate change the thing they're really worried about at the moment? It's going to be very interesting to find out. These are very huge questions, Gary. My thought is, you know, that what the public, it's very difficult for the public, you know, very difficult to make big lifestyle changes if what I do as one person isn't going to save the planet. I've often thought that if, you know, we need to be able to send a clear signal to the government so we actually care and we want something to change. And I often thought, what if everyone just for 1 year said, I'm not getting on a plane. Just for 1 year, I'm not going to holiday abroad. Don't have to go on that holiday. I'm going to holiday where I am. As a clear signal, because, you know, as an individual, getting on a plane and flying is about the most damaging thing one can do to the climate. So you're not really having to give up. You're not costing you anything. You know, I'm going to go with that sort of permanent thing. It's one action. And this is what the research says. If you give people a message and one thing they can do, that will work. If you ask people to give up meat for life, that's very difficult. As a vegetarian, I know, you know, it's not difficult for me, but I know people don't like being told that. So there's the thing. There's no easy answers there, Gary. I think it would be happening already if there were. But if we can connect the message with one action that is a signal to government, we care and we want action, we want something done now, then maybe that's our best hope. But the bottom line is, and there's, you know, you would know this, Gary, there's a lot of reasons why this isn't happening, but it's not that each country, you know, we're not ruled by green parties. So, you know, it's not that when we go to the ballot box, we vote for a Green Party. So there is still a lot of work to be done there. It's a huge issue that has troubled and vexed researchers for many years. And I don't know the answer. I think we'd have had it by now if there was one.
Well, Christopher, you led into a different area that I appreciate, because I don't know how much you follow the presidential campaigns in the United States, but one immediate observation any sane person with a minimal understanding about global warming issues will note is the almost complete lack of conversation about the future threats of climate change, with the exception of the Green Party candidate Jill Stein. And the Republican Party, it's as if it doesn't exist. And among Democrats, it's as if we have plenty of time ahead before we reach 2 degrees Celsius, and let's have another 25 panels, all of insider scientists who have been picked to, in effect, slow the process down so that we can continue to say, just like with smoking, we need more studies. No, we don't. So is it true that this 2 degree number has been overly mythologized in such a way that we reach this magical number if we do and nothing catastrophic happens and everything's fine? That's what the politicians are saying. They're saying, well, things are not that bad. They're not looking at all the different events you've described. They haven't spent any time in Northern Ireland or in Scotland. They have not gone to the coral reefs to see the great die-off you're discussing. They're not looking at all those dead sea creatures that rely upon some other part of the ecological system we're in. You referred to 20% die-off, and what's going to be happening to the 80%. You mentioned that earlier in our discussion. They don't know about any of that. They're 100% ignorant on any of this, and they don't care. Because then you look at who's funding the candidates, and it's people who live by their own laws of evolution. They fly in private jets. In fact, the iron of it is at Davos, which just ended a little while ago, many of the so-called celebrity speakers who were concerned about the environment flew there in private jets and are doing nothing personally to actually address it. And then to the larger question, if we're not dealing with this in American politics, are you dealing with it in British politics? Is anything being done in French or German politics? Where is it being done? Because industries play an enormous role. The Koch brothers are putting over $100 million, which is chump change for them, since collectively they're worth over $60 billion, into this campaign to make sure the candidates they support don't make climate change outside of wind addressing. Yes, we're concerned about the climate, and yes, we're concerned about dealing with it in a professional way, which is a code word for we're never going to deal with this, so we're just going to kick this down the road. So then the question is, if we don't have those leading populist advocates who the people respect, either policy leaders or opinion makers, such as leading celebrities, giving us the right message of what we should unify behind, what we could do, as you mentioned, let's take no airplanes for a period of time, and let's stay at home. Or as you're a vegetarian and I'm a vegan, let's try one day a week going meatless. Just start. I mean, if you tell someone one day a week, that's not your whole life. Just one day a week, it can make a difference. Could you address these issues, please?
Yes, and I'll try and do so very briefly. It's a huge topic, which this is what my book was looking at. So, yes, 2 degrees is the means by which the can is kicked down the road, because it was set up about 20 years ago. And what it meant was it's a problem for the future. And what's happening now is the problem is now. And so what you're finding here in the UK is that they are actually ignoring what needs to be done, or this talk about, okay, we're not going to get 2 degrees. Let's go for 3 degrees, or let's go for 4 degrees. And if you root the problem in an abstract number, you can just change it whenever you want. But if it's rooted in a sense of the core human values which unite us all, it becomes very difficult to tinker with. So what I'd like to say, Gary, is I've done works. I've gone out and spoken to the public, done research. What do you know about 2 degrees? What do you think about 2 degrees? This is what I found. This was in the lead up to the Paris negotiations. This is what I found. I don't know anything about this 2 degrees. What are you talking about? When people get the chance to talk, and just reflecting on this fact that the politicians aren't talking about it, when they come into a room of just people they've never met before, it's a safe space, no one's going to judge you, let's hear what you think about climate change. This is what emerges when we say, well, this is what's at stake with 2 degrees. People become very worried. They start to talk about their worries. They start to talk about how they see the world changing around them, and they're very worried about it. All of a sudden, they don't feel crazy for having these thoughts and worries, because the problem is they don't see anyone else at work, on the television, in the bar. No one's talking about it. So when they have the worries in their mind, they think, well, I better calm down because I'm crazy for worrying about this. No one else is. No one else is talking about it. When we give people the space to talk about it, they start to engage with it. They start to get very cross that no one is doing anything about it. They start to understand what 2 degrees is really about, what that whole thing is about, which is about taking the decision-making process away from people. At the core, you may have to stop me here, Gary, because I could really go on for ages about this. At the core, we're saying, what sort of world do you want to live in? What is the future you want? Is this system, this neoliberal economy, society, where the 1% again, ever more of the money, and the world is being destroyed in the process, and you're working 60, 70 hours a week and getting poorer every day, and so's your partner, and your kids are working ever harder, and there's no future for anyone. Is that worth destroying the world for? That's the trade-off, and that's what's hidden, in essence, by the 2 degrees. Because when you give people that choice, they say, no, of course not. I would want to destroy the world for this, when I'm ever more insecure, and I have ever less money, when I'm working ever harder in a degrading job which does nothing for me, and I can see no purpose to it. Of course not. Who would, it's when you give people the chance to talk about that, then, everyone, it's not a great secret. It's not a scientific mystery. It's not, you don't need to be an expert. You don't need to be intelligent. This is about the core values that we all have, as human beings have always had. And the two-degree idea is actually class warfare. It's a lie which protects the interests of the 1%, allows them to carry on with their destructive, selfish activities at the cost of the rest of us, this generation and future generations. And so that's why they keep it out of the debate, because actually, once you open up that debate, people realize this isn't something that only experts and intelligent people with very expensive educations can engage with and understand. This is about something at the core of all our experiences and all our desires for a better future. So, you know, this finding ways of getting those conversations going, you know, from the bottom up, because people are capable of having them. You don't need to be an expert. You don't need to be a professor or a doctor or anything. It's just about, you know, what sort of world you want. And I don't think really, you know, give them a chance. I don't hear people saying that. I think we should destroy the world because, and it's so great that I can get a bigger TV tomorrow. Even though my job sucks and I'm spending 80, 70, 60 hours a week doing it.
Internal conversations and feelings expressed within the climate change scientific community. At least in the United States, many professors and scientists at universities and major government-funded institutions are prohibited from coming forth in the public and stating their grave concerns over climate change. They are only supposed to provide the science to qualify it at the conservative end so as not to panic anyone, as if the public could not handle the truth. And as a result, that nothing is ever said that represents a threat to societies or humanity at large. Now, as I understand it, climate change is the number one concern among these scientists, not terrorism or the availability of more fossil fuels. So could you summarize for us what you believe is the general tone about climate change and global warming threats to humanity as we know it?
What in my conversations amongst sort of scientists and others who are working on this?
Yes.
For their perspective, yeah, you know, what I'm saying about the level of concern, the anxiety, is largely very profound. There are a few people who feel, you know, when I try and talk, and I've counted a few times, a lot of these people's jobs, not so much the scientists, but the people who are working with policymakers, people who are working with decision makers, people who are working with civil society organizations, their job, the rationale, the reason for doing what they do is all built around the idea that there is a 2-degree dangerous limit. The whole climate change policy story is built on the idea of a 2-degree limit. When I've come in and tried to challenge that, I've been rejected, because what we have in the UK is a piece of policy called the Climate Change Act, and it says if we reduce emissions by 80% by 2050, that's a successful outcome. And that target is based on the idea that climate change won't be dangerous until 2 degrees. Now, we have a range of academic institutions, research bodies, work going on about how to do that, and how to keep this economy as it is, society as it is, but without the nasty emissions. And we've got till 2050 to do it. We've got to find a way to transition to a low carbon economy. I'm sure is a term you and your listeners will be familiar with. So what does that mean? It means keeping neoliberalism going, keeping this paradigm in place, preserving the legitimacy of this way of living, but without the nasty emissions. So there are a group of people, a large body of people, who don't want to hear that the sort of storyline that we've been talking about, that I've been elaborating on, about really what's behind the 2 degrees, who benefits from pretending that climate change won't be dangerous to 2 degrees. You know, so my goal is we've got to find different stories. Well, okay, they don't want to hear that because that story is what their institution is based upon. So there are some who don't want to hear it, who are still critical of what's happening or what isn't happening in terms of policy, but only because it's not going to achieve the 80% by 2050. But that's the limit of acceptable thought. You know, you can't go beyond, you know, if you're progressive, then you are behind the 2-degree goal. There is no other story. But then there are other people. James Hansen, of course, is probably one of the most articulate and well-known people, talking climate scientist. I know he's retired now, but obviously he's very critical of the 2-degree target and says, well, you know, 1 degree is, you know, we're at the dangerous limit already. Others like Michael Mann, who's a very vocal and, I guess, public figure, some of your listeners may be aware of. He's responsible for the hockey stick graph and has come under a lot of attack from sort of the deniers. You know, it's very rooted in the 2-degree idea. He recognises there's problems with it, but nonetheless his narratives are all built around that. But he's a very concerned, very able and very great ally for all of us trying to do something about climate change. So I think that the problem is, okay, so 2 degrees, this is a bit of a longer story, but the, you know, it's what it says is, it says climate change is not a problem of modernity, it's a problem solvable only by modernity. Only by this 2 degrees we need a global architecture of satellites, monitoring systems, laboratories, measurements, you know, the whole, I guess, paraphernalia of modernity, the whole way of we control the world. So it fits into that. To say there is no dangerous limit because the world's too complex and what is dangerous for one person is not dangerous for another is to really say climate change is the terminus of modernity. It's the end of the story of modernity. And for scientists and all those who are working within those institutions of universities, etc., that's a very difficult and challenging story. It's a difficult and challenging story for me to get my head around. What would we say about climate change if there wasn't a dangerous limit? What could we do? I don't know, but there isn't. You know, there's a story we tell to allow for the continuance of what's happening now. And yeah, so that, you know, for scientists, for established, credible people, it can be difficult to get much traction. Or there's acceptance, but what are you going to do instead? There is no other game in town. So I think that, you know, there's a real tension there for people. We've all got to earn a buck. You know, people still need to go out and earn a living. So it's very difficult to negotiate that what's called cognitive dissonance. You're doing one thing, but you know it's wrong. But what else can you do? And so you have to manage that. You have to live and be comfortable with what you're doing every day. And so that may mean pushing that reality aside and keep working towards 2 degrees. We can't do that, 3 degrees, 4 degrees. You know, really, maybe we'll overshoot 2 degrees, but we can turn it back down. We can get back to 2 degrees in the future. So, you know, I think it is really difficult for people who've spent their lives building a career around the 2 degrees storyline to accept that actually it's a bust, that 2 degrees is way over, you know, is under approaching the climate change story through the idea of a global dangerous limit. It's a fallacy, a myth. It's a death sentence for us all. And that, I think, is just too difficult for people to really respond to.
I appreciate those insights. Needless to say, on the one hand, we have a massive amount of power and wealth from those corporations overseen by boards and individuals who have a financial interest to make sure that the profits of their company fall through to their stockholders to keep the value of their company up. If a corporation involved in high gas hydrofracking or oil production or any manufacturing process, coal, for example, were to acknowledge, yes, we're one of the problems, but at the same time say, we are going to take our profit and we are going to put it, instead of advertising and promotion, we're going to put it into renewables. It may take 5-10 years, but at least we're going to go from one source of causing a pollution and energy to one that does not cause that pollution, then I think that the people would understand and would support that. Instead, what we have are corporations who are doubling down. They're hiring a scientist and saying, send the message out that global warming doesn't exist, anomalies do, and that we'll use examples, and because of your credentials, because you're affiliated with some particular institution, you'll get a word in, and we'll get you through think tanks that we control. We have a lot of conservative think tanks, hundreds, and we can get articles sent out into popular press. We can get you interviewed on television. We can get you making trips around college campuses talking about the truth about climate change, where you will acknowledge climate change is happening, but not in any measurable way that's going to be cataclysmic or a disaster. And therefore, you bring down the temperature of the audience. You put them into a mindset where they don't feel threatened. And that's your goal. And we're going to give you a lot of money to do it. And then you have all these legions of scientists, legions of legislators, people within the media who are only too happy to write a pro-industry story because advertising for their publication or their radio station or their PBS or NPR or Fox News comes from these companies. And then you look at, okay, that's balancing one side of the picture. And on the other is a large group of scientists like yourself who have specific and unique experience and insight who are saying, shouldn't we pay attention now? This is a real problem and it's real now. But if we don't deal with it now, by the end of this century, once we hit that 2 degrees Celsius, it's not just 2 degrees hotter. That's not going to do anything if it were just in the atmosphere. Because one day it's 92 and the next day it's 95. Well, gee whiz, that was 3 degrees. So why should I be concerned about 2 degrees? We went from 90 to 105. And in Phoenix, we went from 110 to 125. So we had a big increase. Nothing really bad happened. People just turned on the air conditioner for longer. So people have already been conditioned to disengage, that this is not that important. You know how important it is, and you're trying to help not people now alone, but future generations. So that's why we're doing this series today, because this problem is not going to go away. It's only going to intensify. And I believe that since we do not have any mainstream politician, with the exception of possibly Bernie Sanders, and certainly Jill Stein. But as far as Jill's not getting the media. She's not getting the press. She is a medical doctor, board certified, a Harvard professor, or a Harvard graduate. She has all the credentials to be able to make very important arguments on this issue. And yet the media doesn't care. They're looking for the superstars. And look at Ted Cruz. Look at Donald Trump. Look at all the people who are out there. And look at Hillary Clinton flying in private jets, supporting the military-industrial complex, which is the number one environmental polluter in America. Not a single word about what are you doing with depleted uranium in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Balkans and in Libya. What are you doing about all these toxic munitions in the United States and these testing grounds? What are you doing about nuclear power? Shouldn't we be concerned about it? Well, yes, we should, but we just put $1.7 trillion under Obama into doing a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, as if that's a way to stop nuclear proliferation. And so you look at our leaders, and it doesn't matter which title they moniker themselves with, they're in the same what you said is, do we want people to know the truth about neoliberal policies? Well, we've been living with neoliberal policies since the mid-1950s, and it's only accelerated under each successive group, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Business Roundtable, the Council on Foreign Relations. These are extraordinarily influential, very bright people who have so many interlocking connections. One sits on a board of PBS, but then also sits on the board of a major bank. And another sits on the board of another media company, but also sits on the board of a pharmaceutical company. And another, and you start looking, would you wish, some of these people are on 5 and 10 different boards, and they have enormous wealth. Many of them are $100 million and up. And these are the people who meet at Davos. These are the people who determine that we needed GATT and the World Trade Organization, and so it happened. These are the people who want the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will negate everything you're doing and every other environmental scientist. With the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you will no longer have any of the rules and regulations to temper the excesses of industry on the environment. But they want it, and they're buying it, and it's all done in secret. So when you look at where we're at, you look where we need to be, you look at the enormous effort that you and others are making, the scientific conversations are just not going to do it. They're just not. It's too easy to listen to a scientific conversation and eyes cloud over. Remember, it's like the kid in 10th grade. His hormones are going off the wall. He's thinking of his girlfriend. The world outside that classroom is a lot more exciting than the world inside the classroom for most kids, no matter how brilliant and dedicated the teacher. She's having to compete against things that when you and I were going to school, they didn't have to compete against. So they got more of our undivided attention and the greater ability for us to do critical thinking. So now there's generations who are not doing critical thinking, who are not connected as others were to the environment or to the peace movement or to animal rights movement or to human rights movement or to non-GMO and organic sustainable agriculture. And yet they meaning the oligarchs, the duopolies, the people in power in every country, they know what to give people, and they give them bread and circuses. They give them distraction. They give them reality television. They give them all forms of manufactured drama. They give them the theater of terrorism around the world. When we were growing up, it was the Vietnam War. You come home at night, you turn on the television, and there was, you know, like John Wayne and Iwo Jima, but it was in Vietnam, and we were watching body counts and hearing commentaries from people who were over there. But we weren't there. It wasn't our brother or sister or father coming back in a body bag. We weren't the ones getting the knock on the door. So we didn't connect with it, and we didn't care. It was only after our parents or our siblings or someone or friend came home, either damaged or in a body bag, suddenly we said, what? What's this about? Oh, why is this going on? My friend's dead. My brother's dead. And now we say, what? You mean I shouldn't have had that vaccine? Why did you give hundreds of millions of women that vaccine telling us safe or effective? What do you mean genetic engineering is not as safe as organic? We were told it was. What do you mean that water in Flint is still okay to drink? It's got lead in it. What do you mean? And suddenly it's 1,000 what do you means I believed, and then I have to ask, how much of your belief is based upon intentional ignorance, where you can't handle the truth, you're not going to change, you want someone else to do the change for you? Just a final post-thought from you on those issues.
Thanks, Gary. Yeah, that was a very articulate and very good analogies. And I agree, you know, who am I? I'm just a bitter old man who hasn't got rich, so he wants to stop everyone else having a good time. And let's face it, renunciation of the good life is not very fashionable. It's not going to be welcome music to anyone's ears. So I think that's right. And you're quite right about science. You know, this idea that we are rational creatures who use reason to navigate the world, of course, is probably not true. And we're subject to emotions and those powerful drives. And that's what the marketers and the politicians recognize and use very effectively to maintain their power. And so why do I keep trying in the face of these insuperable odds and the impossibility of, you know, any one person changing anything? And it was always, always, as the father of two children, just being able to look them in the eyes when it all unraveled as a result of climate change, and just say, I tried. Couldn't do it, but I did at least try. And that is why I get up and carry on in the morning. Not because I believe I'm going to change the world, but I don't know how else to get up and get through the day in the face of this if I'm not at least trying and doing what I can.
Fair enough. Well said. Professor Christopher Shaw, from Sussex, United Kingdom, the author of The 2-Degree Dangerous Limit for Climate Change, Public Understanding and Decision-Making, website dangerouslimits.org. Thank you very much for being on and sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's been a real pleasure.
I'm Gary Knoll, and this concludes this segment of our special on climate change. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.